well, over the last, you know, eight or nine weeks, we've built the church. We've established it. We know what it's supposed to do. We know how it worships. We've unified it. We've built up its faith. And I get to tear it apart. The dangers to the church is something that we just have to talk about. It's a very responsible thing to do, I think, at the end of a series like this. It's been a very good series. I think it's been, you know, pretty exciting that we've had nine different teachers, you know, volunteer to teach the class. So I'm thankful to be a part of that rotation. I'm going to use an exit sign today on all of our slides, just kind of as a stark reminder that we are talking about dangers to the church and how we can exit from the way that God would have us to be. You know, if you spend any time on airplanes, and I've been doing a little bit more of that recently, they go out of their way to let you know where the nearest exit is, keeping in mind that it may be behind you. And we need to be aware of where the exits are in our walk on the straight and narrow path. We're going to talk about some of those things today. Exits for us both individually and as the church as a whole. So I start with the question, you know, do we feel the dangers to the church that are out there? Or do we feel that things are good, status quo is going just fine, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, maybe we have our head in the sand, you know, don't really think about that there's really any dangers out there at all? I think after our conversation today, we'll realize that there are some very real things that can take us down. I recall Dad saying, it might have even been in the very first lesson of this series, you know, that upwards of, you know, 90%, I may be misquoting it, of the people that he grew up in the church with, and you may have similar statistics, you know, from your childhood as you think back to your friends, are no longer faithful in the church. You know, those numbers are scary. I think they're pretty real. A lot of things I read on the internet, you know, 75%, you know, seems to be a pretty common number when we think about things like that. So we need to think in our minds, you know, why is that? And we'll try to answer some of those things today. You know, one thing that Janelle does, you know, for our family is she's kind of the keeper of the church directory. And one thing that she does is she keeps a page for all the past members that we've had. And it's kind of interesting, it'd be an interesting exercise if you do that as well, to go back and see, you know, over the last, let's just say 10 years, that's about how long we've been here, the number of people that aren't here today that have been here at some point. Not to say that all those reasons they're here are bad. Some move away, some die, some have started a new work, you know, in the East Valley. Those are all valid, you know, things that can happen to us. But maybe more than we realize or more than we remember, we've had a fair number, you know, fall away. And it's kind of an interesting, almost kind of shocking to go back. And the more sobering question is what will the directory look like 10, 15 years from now? Who's in it today that's going to be missing from it in 10 or 15 years? There's bound to be some. We'll see a verse later, you know, take heed lest you fall. You know, it can happen to any of us. So it's a very sobering thought that dangers are out there lurking. I was originally going to rank the five dangers that we're going to talk about today in order of what I thought was, you know, maybe kind of most important or the greatest danger top to bottom, but I'll kind of let each do their own ranking, you know, by the time we're done with this class. But I think if we were to rank the five things we'll talk about, liberalism, traditionalism, worldliness, formalism, and indifference, you know, that list might have looked different, or it would have looked different, you know, 40, 50 years ago than it did 20 years ago than it does today. These dangers can kind of jockey in positions. Even new things can crop up that aren't on the list. The things we'll talk about today aren't all inclusive, but it's a pretty good list. You know, one of my favorite verses in the Bible is Ephesians 5:15, and it speaks louder than ever. And we talk about the dangers where we are advised to walk circumspectly, not as fools, but as wise, redeeming the time because the days are evil. We need to have our head on a swivel for these dangers and not bury our head in the sand, because that's when we're most vulnerable to these type of things. Second Peter chapter 2, verse 1 was in our handout, and I took the liberty to kind of add some things of myself. These are not the words of Jesus in red. These are the words of some 40-year-old dude in red. I kept the original text in black. I think Dale had done that in one of his lessons where he added a word to the slide to kind of keep the continuity of the original. So anything that you see in red is just something that I've added for our consideration. But 2 Peter 2, verse 1 talks about, you know, false prophets that were among the people, and they're going to be secretly bringing in destructive heresies, even denying the Lord who bought them, and bring on themselves swift destruction. I kind of like the word secretly there. You know, they're not just bold-faced about it. We have to have our guard up. In the following verses, I think what were pretty interesting as well. It says, many will follow their destructive ways. They'll exploit you with deceptive words. Basically means that, you know, we have a target on our back, and their destruction does not slumber. They won't rest. They won't let their foot off the gas pedal in their attempts to win us over. Your liberalism could be defined, you know, for our purposes, a loose attitude regarding the authority of the Scriptures. Hebrews 8:5 talks about a pattern that we must adhere to, and liberalism, as a general rule, appeals to the silence of the Scriptures. How many times have we heard people say, well, the Bible doesn't say I can't do this or I can't do that. You know, if the Bible said you can't be baptized in a tub of rose petals, or we can't have gold Coke Zero and Goldfish at the Lord's Supper, you know, the book wouldn't even fit in this room. I mean, we can't have everything, you know, explicitly prohibited. You know, false teachers were making circumcision a matter of salvation in the first verse of Acts chapter 15 by adding to the apostles' teaching, and then it follows to the verse 24, you know, that there's people that have gone out troubling them with words, unsettling their souls, talking about circumcision being mandatory. And the key part of that verse is, we didn't tell them to say that. There was no such commandment given. They were not authorized to be speaking those things. And I think we've touched on the idea of this in some of the past classes. I know the work of the church that Jason taught, this idea was kind of brought up. It revolves around authority. The worship of the church that Chad taught, the church and the individual that Alan taught. You know, so we're not going to spend just a ton of time on that. But I did look up some things as I think about the silence of the Scriptures. Proverbs is rich. You know, we're studying that right now. A lot about wisdom and not guiding our own path. We see that every word of God is pure. We're told not to add to His words. John 16:13, the Spirit will guide us into all truth. Jude talks about the faith that was once for all delivered to the saints. 2 Peter 1:3, He has given us all things that pertain to life and godliness. The Scripture we know is complete, thoroughly equipped for every good work. If we transgress and do not abide in those teachings, we don't have God. And interesting how, you know, the whole Bible, I mean, short of a verse or two right after that, ends with the warning, don't add to it and don't take away from it. Or the plagues that are written in this book, and death is certain to come. So when I see these verses, it sounds like to me that we have all that we need. And there's no need to go adding to anything like that or making up things on our own. And Nadab and Abihu tried that, and it didn't work out too well. They offered profane fire that he had not commanded, that very thing that he had not commanded. They went on their own and tried to do something outside the boundaries there, outside of the pattern, and they died right on the spot with fire. It's kind of like the classic example, you know, if I told Drew to go to the store and bring me back 1% milk, and he brings me back 1% milk and some mint Oreo cookies, did he abide in what I told him to do? No, he added to it, didn't he? But they go together. Dad, you know, they go together like kids in a jungle gym. We're getting ready to build a new parking lot. We got a lot of kids here. Yeah, let's just cut off a couple hundred square feet in the corner, put a fence around it, have an adult supervise. It's a good thing for them to do, right? You know, they go together. It's no big deal. Can't be taking those liberties. What if he brought me back chocolate milk? I understood what you said, Dad, about the cookies. I didn't bring you cookies this time. I just brought you chocolate milk. It's not what I asked him to bring back, was it? It's like switching the order of the Lord's Supper emblems. It's like, well, you've still got the emblems, but it's not the right way to do it. He brought me back 2% milk. Well, at least it's white this time. I mean, it's just milk. It's white. It's so close. We could just put saltine crackers there instead of unleavened bread. You know, it's real close. That we have no way to be right in adding to and taking from those things. Before we move on, we've got, it's almost like five kind of mini topics within this one lesson. So we'll refer to a lot of scripture. We won't be reading a whole lot of it. So the participation from you will just be, I'll ask for comments. I may ask a question and have you answer it. So before we move on to the next one, any thoughts or anything I may have misrepresented about institutionalism or liberalism?
Just that last verse on the screen there, Leviticus 10:1, which he had not commanded, just struck me looking at the notes. What they said in Acts chapter 15, the apostles, which we had not commanded, the apostles put their word on par with the word of God. I mean, the same language is used. He had not commanded them, that being God.
Mm-hmm.
We had not commanded them. Just a little side point about the authority of the apostles' words and their teaching.
It's funny you say that, because that's the next thing we're going to talk about, actually. You said you couldn't read Vera's mind. You must be able to read my mind, Alan. Anything else? I think, Dad.
In Hebrews chapter 7 and verse 14, it kind of goes along with, or it does go along with what you're saying, but even Jesus himself, under the old law, could not have been a priest, because he came from the tribe of Judah. And of course, priests only came from Levi. And the Hebrew writer makes the argument in 7 and verse 14, says, "For it is evident that our Lord arose from Judah, off which tribe Moses spoke nothing concerning the priesthood." They specified Levi. By default, it left out everything else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you, Brian, for running around. So we can talk about traditionalism for a few minutes. All traditions are bad, right? Traditions kind of get a bad rap a little bit, don't they? For being that way. They're not intrinsically wrong. In fact, a lot of them are actually wise, expedient, and accommodative. Traditions simply mean something, an instruction that has been handed down. And to go along with what Alan was saying, I was going to point out that there's two types of traditions that we read about in the Bible. There's traditions that are used in more of a good sense, the apostolic traditions, more that are equivalent to divine commandment, which is exactly where you were headed. 1 Corinthians 11:2, Paul was telling the Corinthians to keep the traditions just as I have delivered them to you. The Thessalonians were told in 2 Thessalonians 2:15 to stand fast and hold the traditions which you were taught, whether by word or epistle. And one chapter later, in 2 Thessalonians 3:6, we command you in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ that you withdraw from every brother who walks disorderly and not according to the tradition which he received from us. So those traditions, on par with direct commandments, like Alan said. And then the other traditions that we read about are the harmful traditions from men, the traditions that are condemned. Colossians chapter 2, verse 8. Beware lest anyone cheat you through philosophy and empty deceit, according to the tradition of men, according to the basic principles of the world, and not according to Christ. In Matthew chapter 15 and verse 3, and it'll lead up to what verses 8 and 9 are talking about here. Jesus told the Pharisees, "Why do you also transgress the commandment of God because of your tradition?" Human tradition. There they were speaking about the loophole that the Pharisees tried to find with honoring and taking care of their parents. And then in verses 8 through 9, Jesus said, "These people draw near to me with their mouth." You know, they kind of give a lip service. "They honor me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. And in vain they worship me, teaching as doctrine the commandments of men." So I think that the traditions that concern us today, you know, in my mind, don't seem to be the ones that where we're trying to bind something relative to salvation, like some of these things that we've talked about already were, but more of the way that we do things in the realm of expediency and human judgment. You know, these are the type of traditions that we'll spend kind of a few minutes on. And I think the danger of traditionalism is reflected for us, like it says on the screen, in the attitude that says, "Well, we've always done it that way, so it's got to be right." And it may be right. If we change the way we do things, we're wrong. You know, you see just kind of a deep-rooted grasp on the way things have always been done. I'll take it a step further and say, you know, we've always done it that way, and we're really not going to entertain the idea of doing it differently. Just be holding on so tight to traditions that it just really becomes a stumbling block. It may be kind of a dumb example or a dumb parallel, but I'm going to use it anyway. If I were to say that my mom has the best chocolate chip cookies around, maybe she does, maybe she doesn't. But how can I know that for sure if I'm unwilling to try Nancy's cookies or Vera's cookies or Sherilyn's cookies or Adrian's cookies? I won't know until I've tasted the other ones. So I have to be willing to try the other cookies before I know that the way I currently do it or what my current product is the best ever. And I think that's why traditions can become a danger. You know, it's possible that holding on to traditions can make us too comfortable because we've done them for so long. Maybe they could lead, you know, to laziness or even worse, closed-mindedness. I think that's where we kind of get into the sticky area there, and that's kind of the danger as I see it for traditions. Now, the elders have a unique role in this area. They get to decide, rightfully so, obviously, on things that are done. Sometimes they may ask our input if the topic deserves it, and sometimes they may not. And that's perfectly understandable. Kind of depends on the question at hand. But we as members, we as the flock, we need to be flexible enough to, you know, if they decide that something is going to change, that we fall in line and we follow and we move forward. So all parts of the local church have a role as we view traditions. Yes, Brian.
I was just going to say that you sort of made the caveat in the beginning where, you know, there were a lot of issues back then that were matters of salvation, and they sort of had these traditions that really became matters of salvation. And we need to be really careful, I think, today to be aware of what is a tradition and acknowledge it as such, and what is actually the right thing to do, and to be able to make that clear distinction between them so that we don't try to teach somebody something that's just purely tradition, or we don't try to condemn somebody based on something that's purely our own tradition. You know, it's a silly example, but it's the, you know, it's the common Church of Christ time for beginning services right on Sunday morning. Like, well, they don't start at 9:30, so they must not be a scriptural group. Or, you know, they don't have a song in between the Lord's Supper and the giving, so they must not be a scriptural group. I mean, there's all sorts of small things that we might have adopted over the years, and we need to be really careful that we that we don't use those and view other people through those traditions and sort of judge them as being, you know, righteous or unrighteous because of those things.
Yeah. No, we're gonna. It's a fly there, I promise. We're going to talk about some of those very things here in just a minute. Yeah, is taking the Lord's Supper on the first day of the week a tradition? No, that's a commandment. You know, there's no flexibility there. You know, so like you said, we have to know the difference between commands and traditions, and we need to pray for wisdom on the elders' behalf because they've got a tough job, and they do it well, and they love us. Before we get into listing some of the things that, you know, maybe along those lines that are traditions as I kind of see them, can anyone name a good reason to break from tradition? What would be something that would prompt that?
I would say as congregations change, the face of the congregation changes. Maybe the need of the congregation might change, and so a change in how things are done would cause maybe a change in how things are done. If a group coming through has a lot of individuals that are wanting to get involved in stuff, or maybe not necessarily have a problem with what is being done, but have input or what have you, and the face of the congregation changes, maybe the things that were done before might need to change along with it, because the original group that was there initially, the traditions that were set forth or the process was set for that group. Well, over a 5, 10, 15-year process, the face of the congregation might change, and then, you know, might need to reassess that as well at that point.
You know, I think that's valid. I had written down a few things, and that was definitely one of them, whether it's the culture or the demographics, or what have you, does change as time goes by. Frank?
Yeah, just to add on to the needs of the congregation, you know, it may be something where socially there's things that conflict, and, I mean, everybody's seeing the middle of the week. The numbers aren't what you see up there today. Maybe changing the day, you can get higher numbers in the middle of the week. You know, that's something that is purely at our discretion, and if it will help edify the body, there's no reason we can't change that.
Yeah. Adrian?
If something we're doing becomes a stumbling block, then we should be willing to change for the sake of someone else's soul.
Also, if we attach ourselves to the purposes of what we're doing and not the practices or the way we're doing it on expedience, then we'll find ourselves changing often what our practice is within the constraints of you know, what God has said to do, because we're just focused on finding the best way to do it, whether it's, you know, to glorify God, to reach the community, to edify one another. We're fenced in by, as we've talked about, the authority of what's acceptable, but within that, it won't be a big deal to change if we stay focused on the goals of what we're doing.
Yeah, I like that. Technology changes. That can change the way we do things sometimes. I think John had his hand up.
There are changes on Sunday already that we know of. Sometimes we meet only at 2 and not like the normal 9:30. That's a change, and we have to ask ourselves, why is this okay? Well, we still have the Lord's Supper on Sunday, so that makes it okay. But we're only doing it once. There's a reason why. And understanding that reason, it becomes a positive change the elders have directed us toward doing. But that's an example of something that is a change. We do that a few times a year at least, and there are reasons for doing that that I believe are positive. And so to the elders, that's why we do those That's why we do that change.
Yeah. I mean, some churches are even going to one service on Sunday, you know, period, anyway. If I recall, you know, when gas prices were getting a little nutty a few years ago, I think the elders even sent out a survey, you know, kind to, you know, gauge, you know, are things like this affecting your ability to come twice? You know, we all live, you know, 30, 35 minutes from here or plus, you know, and we come here for a reason. We're happy to come here. But the fact is that there's a distance involved. And, yeah, I mean, even that. Sometimes, you know, just improving, wanting to improve a process is a reason to break from tradition. You know, if Apple didn't make any changes to the iPhone they released a couple weeks ago that was different from the previous phone, they wouldn't have sold it. There's continuous improvement all around us. You know, Drew's soccer coach is always looking to improve the new drills that he can have to make these six-year-old boys understand some fundamental things on the soccer field. You know, at work, we're always trying to, you know, look at ways to improve, you know, our processes, whether it makes it, you know, safer or more efficient or what have you. You know, we embrace the diversity that we have on our teams at work to accomplish those things. And I think of, you know, the Goodwin family, the Monaco family, you know, we've really just actually introduced more diversity into our family here, and that's a good thing. Maybe they've got a better recipe for making cookies, you know, to use our example, you know, from earlier. And we won't know unless we, you know, lend them an ear. Brian.
I was just going to say all this discussion is kind of, it just highlights again the magnitude of what the elders have the responsibility to do. And because everybody, I think every one of us probably have our ways of doing things. Like, well, if it was up to me, I would choose to do it this way or that way or this other way. And so there is a sense that the elders have this balance that they have to strike between keeping things consistent and predictable and orderly while still looking for the best ways of doing things. And as you know, as heads of our own households, as fathers, we kind of have that responsibility as well, that we have to, you know, continually approach every day as a new challenge, that we have to provide a consistent home for our children, but then still push them to grow and nurture them. You know, it's all these, it's just dangerous, I think, to go too far in either direction, to go too far into, I guess, the liberalism piece that we just talked about, versus the other end of the spectrum, which is just this strict traditionalism where we just think about nothing and we consider nothing and we just do it the way we always did it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the pendulums can swing you know, either direction. That's why I kind of started this whole section with, you know, traditions are okay. You know, they're expedient in a lot of ways. But, you know, if the elders, we'll take a look at a couple here that we have. If the elders decided to change any of the few things that we'll talk about here, you know, what would our reaction be? How would we react? You know, you talked about times of services. There's certainly nothing written in stone about that. We're not married to these times. If it changed in the future, then, you know, then so be it. What songbook we use? That's a choice we have, that there's choices out there. We're commanded to sing. We can use that as an expedient. And let's take that to the next step. What about the electronic version, you know, of the songs that some churches are going to these days? Good, bad, indifferent? I don't know. But it's a choice. You know, it's an option. And that's kind of why I mentioned technology earlier as being, you know, one possible reason to break from tradition, you know. We're changing the way we record things that we're probably doing right now with increased capabilities.
One of the things we did 3 or 4 years ago, the elders remember, the work groups would meet on Sunday evening. You got it?
I do.
Okay, well, sorry.
No, go ahead.
Sunday evening, and we met for 5 minutes and basically mailed out cards. And that's okay. That's what we did. So we decided, or I think we actually had some input and said, what if we were to do this on Sunday morning after services? You know, you're getting into lunch. People may, you know, all of that. So we were a little hesitant about it and said, okay, let's try it for, seems like a maybe a two or three months, I forget now. And instead of 5 minutes, maybe we'll squeeze it up to 10, 12, even 15 minutes, but we're going to expand the role of the work groups. Going to try it. And all that worked out actually really well.
It did.
And it is working out real well, and the work groups have taken on a heavier load than they used to. I don't know if you call that a tradition or not, but that's what we did, and we just thought we'd try it and to see if it would work. And if it didn't, we would have gone back.
Right. No, I did. I've had that list of that very thing, and I suspect one of the reasons you guys did it was, you know, the Sunday night attendance was poorer than Sunday morning attendance. So why not bring the activity to where the people are, you know? I mean, it made perfect sense. And I think there was increased excitement and increased vigor there that still probably goes on today. The work group leaders do a great job. I labeled the tradition. I had it as one of my things I was going to talk about as a positive, you know, change, where we looked at something that it wasn't broke. Just because you change something doesn't mean what's currently in place is broken. I mean, there was nothing wrong with what was going on, but it got better. You know, there was a better cookie recipe there, and we found it. I think of even, you know, classes like this. You know, if I were, you know, to put myself in an elder's shoe, I'd like, you know, these classes are awesome at feeding the flock. I mean, the design of this material, the design of, you know, the parable class material on Monday nights. A couple years ago, Mike Kircher did a Sunday afternoon class on the names of God. The pretty cool, you know, 6-week class, very insightful. But you look around on the attendance on Sunday afternoon, where people are at home taking a nap, you know, quite frankly, and not being here, is less than it would be on regular, you know, class time, regular quote unquote class times on Sunday morning. You know, is it possibility that classes like this could kind of, like a work group, shift toward where the people are? I don't know. I mean, sounds maybe reasonable. I think the elders are possibly considering, you know, as they look years ahead, as they plan years ahead at gospel meetings. You know, there's a lot more meetings being held that are half-week meetings, you know, 3-day, 4-day kinds of meetings. And because attendance, I think, in general, you know, not only here but across the country is waning at those events. In fact, Ryan Goodman's brother is doing a 3-day one right now out at East Valley, you know. Friday, Saturday, maybe twice on Saturday, I don't remember, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, you know. And if a concentrated, you know, bolus of spiritual activity on a topic is the way that people will better attend it, then, you know, maybe you move the meeting structure to where the people are. You know, there's nothing, in, you know, as long as we're not changing the foundation of what's being had, you know, we're feeding the flock maybe more effectively in those ways. You know, Ryan and Brian on the radio program a month or two ago, they did something a little different. Both of them got on the radio. I don't know if you heard. I think it was twice they did it. And it was more of a kind of a question and answer, kind of a conversational, you know, 30-minute program versus one person talking. Just my opinion, I thought it went really well. I mean, it was intriguing to listen to. We know it was kind of, you know, thought out and staged, but it didn't sound staged. I mean, it was very conversational. We broke from what we normally do on that, but it seemed to work okay. The message was still spread. The message wasn't watered down. You know, nothing was really different about it except that there's two people talking instead of one. You know, ending our Sunday morning service with God is so good. If the elders decided at some point that song is no longer the way we're going to end our service, we should be totally fine with that. You know, there's nothing magical about that song. It's a good song. Like singing it. Maybe we end with a prayer. Maybe we end with a song that the song leader rotates as a different song. I don't know. But that's a tradition that we have that we should be willing to, you know, let go of should that day come. Maybe it will, maybe it won't. So there's lots of things we could kind of look at. And my point was to, you know, not list out every little thing. I mean, we could spend, you know, the rest of the time on a lot of these topics, but I think we got the flavor for, you know, for being open to change. But I think something that Dad pointed out that I did want to end this section on, you know, no matter what might be done differently in the future than it had in the past, you know, it doesn't have to be a grand slam in order to be considered a success. And if it's not a grand slam, doesn't mean it's a failure. You know, there's things we may try. The work group thing might have not yielded a bit of difference, you know. Who knew? Maybe you try it. But at the very least, you know, you tried it, you learned something, and you move on to the next thing. Any questions or comments on this before we head on over to some more good stuff? Cool. Worldliness. Wow. Big exit sign here. there's a lot of causes of worldliness. You know, the original slide here captured probably the two biggest ones. Loving the world, you know, we're told not to do that in 1 John 2. Don't love it. Don't love the things in it. And if you do, the love of the Father's not in it. We see that the rich young ruler allowed that to happen to him. You know, Alan had that on his radio program a couple weeks ago. Well, he called him the young rich ruler instead of the rich young ruler. I love the way that you must have been saying that for decades in that order, because I noticed you called him the young rich ruler. It's kind of funny. But he allowed the things of this world to stand in his way. Friendship with the world. I mean, there's a strong word here that's enemy. Whoever wants to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. Demas loved the present world too much and gave up there in 2 Timothy 4, verse 9, where that's recorded. I added a few more. Causes of worldliness is just getting too close to it, conforming to the world, as we're told not to do in Romans chapter 12, verses 1 and 2. And it shows that we can, if we use the world as our standard, you know, we're in trouble. I read something the other day online about using the world as our standard and what that would do over time if we continued to drift with the world. If I was cool enough with charts, I could have drawn you a nice chart and made it graphical, but I think if you just follow along in this paragraph, you'll kind of follow me. Let's say that the church is always 10 miles closer to God than the world is. The problem is that as the world moves to the left, away from God, so does the church. That is, if we move in unison with the standard of the world. So now we're still 10 miles away from the marriages of the world, the sexual standards of the world, and their hardness and their love of material things. But as the world moves faster and faster away from God's standards, so do we. We're still the same distance from our culture. So in our mind, you know, we feel like we're still hanging in there doing the right things because we started here, the world started here, and we've moved in unison far away from where the standard of God would be here at point zero. Where if we stood at the standard of God and stayed there and the world kept drifting, our light would shine even brighter because we kept a larger distance. As the world moved away, we didn't change instead of moving with it. It's the danger of having that moving target of the world as our standard. And what we would find if we used it that way, where we would end up, you know, a period of time later, is actually where the world started and said we'd never be at the very beginning. If we should have stayed at zero, the world started at three. We end up at three, the world's at six. We should be at zero and six, but we're at three and six. Three is where the six used to be. I know I just confused you because I've got a math brain, but I think you kind of get what I'm saying. If we use the standard that way and drift with it, we keep drifting farther and away from God, but our light won't shine if that distance doesn't spread, because we know the world is moving in the wrong direction. To being spotted by the world, which James tells us that we need to not to do. Listening to worldly wisdom First Corinthians. We've studied a lot about that in Proverbs recently too. Partaking in the works of the flesh. You know, Proverbs just warned us a few chapters ago, never, don't even go near the path. You know, you're never going to get far down the path if you don't even start on the path. It's pretty hard to get a DUI if you don't take your first drink. Not rocket science, but that's how we can, you know, worldliness can creep in. Some cures for worldliness. In Romans 12, the way we just referenced, you know, make a conscious decision not to be squeezed into the mold of the world. There's people and places and practices that we need to avoid. A comforting message in 1 Corinthians 10:13, God does give us a way of escape. We need to find it, and we need to use it. Rick talked last week about increasing our faith, denying ungodliness and worldly lust, and being separate. We can't remove ourselves from the world. We have to live in it. But we need to be careful to be separate. James 4, 7 and 8 gives us some good tips. Submit to God, resist the devil, draw near to God, purify your heart. These are the type of things that we can do to combat the worldliness that's just peppering us from all angles. Well, what are some ways that worldliness can creep into the church? You know, this was more kind of, you know, me personally, individually, my battles and things. But what are some ways that this can kind of creep in and start affecting everybody? Because we bring it with us. A little leaven leavens the whole lump. And if I start bringing in some of my, you know, maybe it's modesty issues, maybe it's my speech that's losing its salt, maybe the world is rearranging my priorities, and you can sense that, and I start rubbing off on you. I mean, that's how things, you know, our influence with one another just spreads very, very quickly that way.
Just to highlight the responsibility of our homes, you know, husbands and wives, we would notice it a lot faster, worldliness creeping into the church, if we kept our homes pure. You know, it starts creeping into the home before it ever gets into the church.
Mm-hmm.
And so you asked about how to combat that. I think if we did a better job in homes, in the home atmosphere, all of a sudden, if it did come into the church, now it's, whoa, you know, this is a big deal.
Yeah, it's part of the reason we lose our kids, you know, they spend, you know, 30 hours a week at school where they hear things that are contrary to the word. They come home and they spend about 30 hours a week. I've read, you know, on the internet, on Facebook, watching TV, you see the commercials, you know, all the things that they get peppered with. And we think that, you know, 45 minutes of a Bible class a week is good enough to combat what the other 60 hours is doing to them.
We're told Romans 12:9, right after that, tells us to abhor what is evil, to hate what is evil, and to cling to what's good. And I think one of the things that can happen with worldliness, with just all the pressure around us, the beginnings of that conforming, is not to make us like those things that are out there that we know are sinful, but to just soften our hatred for them, mm-hmm. soften our distaste. That's not that bad. Let's make sure we make space for other people, you know, whatever. I don't know.
Yeah.
That's being pushed so much, you know, to be tolerant of these things. And we need to maintain our firm stance.
Yeah. I think that goes back to our graph. You know, if we drift along with it, we'll be desensitized as we go along.
One of the things that the hard things for the elders that we have to do at times is, and one of the first questions we ask is your marital divorce situation kind of question, and it doesn't always go well. And the thing with, I mean, it is what it is. God has defined what an unscriptural marriage is. We didn't write it. But the thing about if you do not guard that, and there are lots of other, but that is part of the world. If we do not guard that, then pretty soon the church at a certain location becomes notorious for, it only gets worse.
Yeah.
Once you start accepting things that are unscriptural, you become noted for that, and there are many others on the way. But it's not easy. But we didn't draw the line. God did. But to tell somebody that you cannot be a member here, that's very difficult.
Yeah.
And there's been tears shed over that. But it is what it says, what it says, and means what it means. But, boy, is it's tough.
Yeah.
It's tough on the people. It's tough on the elders to have to say that.
Yeah, that's probably one of the largest ways that the worldliness tries to creep in. You're right. And you guys do a good job of keeping watch.
I think two key pieces have to be there to keep worldliness out, and that's having courage and love for purity. I mean, we're reading all throughout Proverbs where, you know, wisdom yells out to us constantly, and we're to seek it like it's precious to us. It's the most valuable treasure that we have to seek after. It's something that we should seek after. And if we don't have courage and love for it, then that's where worldliness comes in. Because if we don't have courage to raise our children right or discipline them like we talked about this morning, or if the elders don't have courage to speak to people about those tough topics and have those conversations with them, then it just kind of seeps its way in because, you know, there's not such a love for the truth that courage is there to be able to have those conversations.
Yeah, no, I agree. I read a quote the other day talking about kind of worldliness, and we have to be in the world. You know, we're the ship in the ocean. So when the ship is in the ocean, everything's fine. It's when the ocean gets into the ship that you're in trouble. And that's kind of the way worldliness is.
And just to kind of couch what you're saying there, you know, we have a really delicate balance, again, to strike, that we hate worldliness, but we love those who are in the world who are lost. And I think that's it's a really dangerous thing if we start to become that Pharisaical person who looks at Jesus who was eating with tax collectors and sinners and say, well, you just shouldn't have anything to do with those people. I mean, we as the church are seeking to be pure, but at the same time, we're looking for those who are unclean and who are sinful, and that's it's a delicate balance to strike there. But that's, you know, we need to not shut out the world while we're trying to shut out the world. You know,
yes. Anyway. Yeah. All right. Well, we've got about 5-10 minutes here. I might take a few extra minutes since we started a couple minutes late, but we're getting there. This is good. Two left. Formalism and emotionalism are kind of bucketed together, and then indifference. So we'll kind of go through it. Formalism, talking about our worship becoming stale and stagnant, and I like the phrase, just going through the motions. You know, have you ever felt like that? Have you ever felt, you know, a shade on the robotic side, you know, at church? I mean, I think we all have. That's certainly a danger. John chapter 4, 23 and 24 says we worship in truth and in spirit. We need both. Truth isn't enough. We need to have the right spirit when we're here. We kind of covered some of that with the worship at the church with Chad's class. And I'm reminded of the church at Ephesus that we read about in the second chapter of Revelation, where they were told they left their first love. This is kind of what it feels like to me. They were doing a lot of good things on the surface. And in fact, you know, they were commended for some of the things they did, very good things. At the end of the day, they were told something was missing and their heart wasn't in it. Kind of going through the motions, if you will. I think, you know, going through the motions is going to make us be the type of person that's last to arrive and first ones to go from church. We won't be welcoming to the visitors. We could stop living our lives with purpose. Our focus turns from serving Christ to serving self. Our spiritual growth is stopped. We're not cognizant of the lost people around us, to Brian's point. We don't look for opportunities around us to do good for others. You know, those are all things that can be a byproduct of just kind of going through not only here, you know, in worship times, but just in our daily lives. You know, do we give thought to what we're doing? Do we give our best? Then emotionalism, I won't really spend a lot of time, you know, on this. people that are on fire for the Lord, on zeal without knowledge is kind of the main verse there. I think of, Holy Rollers, or there's a show on TV called Snake Salvation. I won't watch it because I don't like snakes, but they're just kind of getting it's all emotion and just not a whole lot else to it, I'm sure. I'll have to take your word for it if you've watched it. But, I guess when you're researching things or just looking around, you see quotes all over the place, but with regards to our feelings, and you can get to Dennis, feelings are a lot like waves. We can't stop them from coming in, but we can choose which ones to surf.
There's no real deep commitment if you're basing things on an emotion.
Yeah, or it won't last very long.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. No, I would agree with that. I think the last one here, indifference. Boy, oh boy, I told you I wasn't going to rank them all 1 to 5, but I'll give you my first one, and I think it's this one. It's kind of a shame we've got about 5 minutes left, but apathy is, that's a tough one to cure, man. Indifference, I think, usually intends to do no harm, but it can be as destructive as persecution, false teaching, division, and strife. The church is a living body. And indifference just thrusts a dead feeling on that body and damages it and doesn't let the body work the way it should. The rest of the church has to compensate for the lethargic, apathetic, indifferent ones. And that puts kind of an unequal imbalance or a strain, if you will. And I think that's why, indifference is just, it's just tough. It's tough to deal with. Why are we indifferent? I think the prosperity of our nation kind of plays into that a little bit. It kind of robs us of our sense of spiritual poverty, if you will. When things are going well, we don't feel like we need a whole lot of God, need a whole lot of religion in our lives. So I'm doing pretty good by myself. I think that plays into it. We procrastinate at times. I think the lack of urgency plays into that. But the Bible speaks very clearly about the urgency of Christian obedience and service in no uncertain terms. Your life is a vapor, and all these things that say you better take care of what you need to today. And the indifferent person just doesn't seem to care about that. Indifference is tough. I've heard it said that indifference is the thief in the church. Indifference robs our time, robs our talent, robs our support for each other, kidnaps members out of Bible classes, holds down members' attendance, saps the enthusiasm out of members, sabotages good programs, and takes the pleasure out of serving the Lord. Could probably just sit down now. I mean, that summed up kind of what indifference will do for you. And I would think that's probably one of the, if it's not the number one, probably the hardest thing the elders have to deal with is, how do I light the fire where I can see, a fire, needs to be lit. It's so difficult to impress upon the urgency of someone's need to act when they're kind of numb to that need. If you will. So that's my quick little indifference speech. Now comments.
I'll put my Alan hat on from his lesson this morning. It's, the point, I mean, if we go around kind of like a social club or a PTA or something, we just kind of push a lot of, human wisdom and a lot of book learning on people, that's never going to endear someone to be on fire for the work that we're doing as much as it would if we preached Christ. When it's about Christ, there's no place for indifference.
About as pure as it gets. Yeah.
And if when we lose view of Christ, when we lose the view of someone who was God but came here as a man and suffered and died for us, how can you be indifferent to that?
Yeah.
And I think that's, if you lose that, I think it's probably the key thing that you have to get back. before you can become on fire again.
Yeah. Dale, Glenn, Dad, any thoughts as we wrap up the class here and try not to trip on any bolts? And thanks to Jason, by the way. I think the whole pew carpet thing has taken a couple months off his life. So when this is all said and done, pat him on the back when this is complete here in a few weeks. All right. Until next time. Thanks.